I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 14 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is David Brooke of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hello, hello, hello. Ready for day four? Well, my day four. Your day.
Well, my day 14.
Yeah.
But it's so wonderful of you to think of me. So episode 14 begins with a lot of commotion in the drugstore and ends with everyone staring at Violet as she's leaving. So, you know, we continue along George's journey. You know, he at some point, you know, they give us the transition of him in the, leaving or in the luggage store. And then the next thing we see is he's walking into the, you know, the Gower's drugstore, which we've obviously seen before. But we saw it years earlier, and, you know, he walks into there, and we see that it's a lot busier now than it was, you know, back then when George was working there beforehand. You know, what we talked about at the beginning of this week and last week, he didn't have very many customers, but here, you know, it's a bustling place. I guess, you know, the fact that everyone doesn't know that Gower almost killed a little kid, you know, helps business. Or it probably would have hindered it if they had found that out, obviously. But, you know, and George walks in and he walks over towards Mr. Gower and goes, "Hello, Mr. Gower, how are you? Thanks ever so much for the baggage. It's just exactly what I wanted." And he goes, "Oh, forget it. Oh, it's wonderful of you to think of me. Hope you enjoy it." You know, we never get to really see the full geography of the whole, you know, I guess you could sort of say Main Street of Bedford Falls. I mean, in the commentary that I talked about earlier this week, you know, they mentioned that this was the largest set ever built at the time, and they created three blocks of stores. Wow. You know, but we don't know if the luggage store is right next to the drugstore or whatever. You know, we just know that George leaves there and comes here at some point. You know, because it's not a shot where we're following him to get to there. So we're not 100% sure about the whole thing. But he, you know, again, it says so much about his personality that whether he's going out of his way or not, it doesn't make a difference. But George is still taking the time to go into the drugstore and thank Mr. Gower for giving him this present.
Yeah, yeah. Showing the kind of tight-knit community and the love between everyone.
That's right. And, you know, he refers to Gower as my old boss. So it's not even, you know, it's not that he's continuing to work there. It's something that when he was a kid, that was his part-time job or whatever, after-school job or whatever it is. You know, but he still has formed a connection with this man who he's harboring a deep secret for. You know, so it shows George's forgiving nature. You know, he can forgive the fact that Gower beat him to the point where his ears were bleeding. You know, that must, you have to be hit quite a lot for that to actually happen. And, you know, he doesn't hold any grudge against him for that, which again says a lot about who George Bailey truly is. And, you know, he's coming to thank him, and he's going out of his way to greet Gower, but Gower at the same time comes towards him, you know, in order to say, don't worry about it. And then George looks over to his right, and he sees the cigar lighter that we talked about last week also. You know, and he quickly opens it up and he closes his eyes and he goes, "Oh, I wish I had $1 million. And then he goes, Hot dog. Nope, it's not the end of this. Not the end of the minute yet. Hot dog. Hot dog.
They've got Mr. Gower. They've kind of dressed him and groomed him like drastically different from previous scenes, well, to show he's kind of moved on. He's happy. He's kind of in a better place. And
you know, so he slaps. Did you notice how he slaps George's hand? You know, like with friendship.
It's like
the 8 second mark where they show that. You know, again, it shows that Mr. Gower, even though he knows that George is keeping the secret, you know, they still, you know, it hasn't caused any trouble between them.
Mm.
You know, Mr. Gower still trusts George and whatever.
Yeah, and it shows that Mr. Gower appreciates that he's that George is part of his kind of coming back around and kind of living life again sort of thing. Really, he wouldn't have had a chance if George was, as we're going to learn much further down the line.
That's right.
It would have been a different story.
That's right. You know, he also, Mr. Gower, we see, gets a kick out of the fact that George is still doing the cigar lighter thing. You know, he starts laughing along with him, which we talked a little bit about that last week, but it's a very interesting idea that in this drugstore / candy store / soda shop, they're going to have, you know, this cigar lighter or another wipe of the screen as it moves to a different location. And we see George walking down walking down a street, and we see in the back, you know, signed for a meat market and something else that I think it looks like it's for the tailor or whatever. And he's walking down the street, and then he looks up and he hears someone screaming at him. And he looks up and he sees three people hanging out the window of what we see is the Bailey Brothers building and loan. These three people, one of them is his uncle, Billy, who we saw the beginning of the week, at the end of the tail end of last week. But at the beginning of this week, he's also, we see him for a few seconds there, you know, constantly having to try to remember things. And we then also see there are basically two cousins of George that work there. And it's never really explained how they're related. But you have Eustace and Tilly. So, you know, it's very strange that they're seen as cousins without any real explanation. They're not Billy's kids. So the question is, how are they related? You know, like, where's the rest of the Bailey brood?
Yeah.
You know, where they come, are they, you know, is it that Peter and Billy have a sister and this is their, her children or whatever? It's never really clear. But at least in the script that I read, which the reason I don't go through differences in the script here is because there really aren't that many differences. It's almost exactly word for word. So it's possible that the scripts that I found were post movie scripts as opposed to pre movie scripts, you know, where it was before they made it. It's pretty much everything that's written there is in the movie, but what they do have is a few descriptions of who some of the characters are and stuff like that. And they mention the fact that both Tilly and Eustace are George's cousins, but they never state from where. So it's a little strange. And you can actually also see the name of the street that they're on. Did you notice the name of the street?
Genesee Street and Jefferson Avenue, yeah.
Yeah, have you ever heard name. Exactly. I've never heard that phrase before, Genesee. Jefferson, you know, we know all about. It's it's probably named after Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. So I looked up Genesee, and I actually found that there were two U.S. Naval ships that were named the USS Genesee.
Mm.
One of them was a tugboat during World War I and World War II. It was built in 1905, and it was actually blown up in 1942 by its crew in order to avoid capture at Carrageedore. You know, the Japanese actually took it over and, you know, renamed it Patrol Boat Number 107. 2 years later, the U.S. forces actually bombed it and they sunk it. You know, so it's interesting that, you know, this was a ship that they tried to destroy and weren't able to, and then the enemy used it until, you know, you know, the U.S. Planes then had to go and destroy their own ship. The second USS Genesee was sent out on in September 1943. So basically, that is a year and a half after the previous one was captured. It was eventually commissioned on the 27th of May 1944. So again, it only during the last year of the war itself was it part of anything. It was a ship that was used to carry things. It was a carrier. It's a tanker. It was a gasoline tanker that they used. But they would send it on dangerous tasks of transporting gasoline to warships and to remote naval stations and stuff like that. It served in World War II, the Korean War, and in the Vietnam War. And I found this interesting by reading this article that even ships were given, you know, different types of campaign stars and things like that. Like you would mark on the ship that this ship was part of this particular battle or campaign and stuff like that. Cool. And it was eventually decommissioned and then it was sold to Chile and they renamed it the Beagle. And it was a submarine tender that was used by the Chilean Navy up until 1982. After that, it was used for basically target practice and then it was sunk in 1992 in a live fire exercise. So and what is probably the most the deeper connection of what Genesee is, there is actually a town in upstate New York called Genesee Falls, which is a very small town because there are only 438 people that live there.
Wow.
But the idea that it, you know, is relatively close to where this movie takes place makes you wonder if that was done on purpose, because this isn't, you know, it isn't a typical name for them to throw out as the name of a street.
I wonder if, I mean, the film was made obviously not long after the war, so I don't know if it was anything to do with those battleships or I don't know.
Yeah, for some reason I doubt it, but
probably not
anything as
well. Because Capra was in the war, wasn't he? He was a major, and he did a lot of the Why We Fight movies and things, the propaganda movies and things like that.
That's right. Then Uncle Billy screams out, "Avast there, Captain Cook, you got your sea legs yet?" And then Eustace screams out, "Parlez-vous français, mister? Hey, send us some of those picture postcards, will you, George?" And then Billy screams, "Hey, George, don't take any plug nickels." So the first thing that I found interesting is that they mentioned Captain Cook. Do you know who Captain Cook was?
Yes. Well, he's... I know the name, and he traveled the world, but I don't know a lot of the details other than that.
Right. So he was Captain James Cook was born on the 7th of November 1728 and died on the 14th of February 1779. He was a British explorer, cartographer, and naval officer who had three famous voyages between 1768 and 1779 in the Pacific all the way to New Zealand and Australia. He actually made a detailed map of Newfoundland before going out into the Pacific. He is the first recorded European contact with the eastern coastline of Australia and the Hawaiian Islands, and he is the first person to be recorded to circumnavigate New Zealand. He did some interesting stuff there. And at some point while he was there in 1779, between him and the natives of Hawaii, they got into a fight. And he ended up getting killed in that fight. You know, so he didn't make it back, back home afterwards.
That was 51.
Yeah. Then one of the other things they mentioned here is plugged nickels. Do you have any idea what that means?
I'm guessing like a fake nickel, but I've never heard of it called a plug before. I don't know.
The idea is to basically shave off small portions of precious metal for profit. Again, I don't really understand the reference here of when he says, you know, don't take any plug nickels. You know, meaning is that maybe the idea that don't take anything that they've shaved off some of the value of it, maybe?
I don't know. I think he'll get in trouble if he's trying to do his usual tricks or something. I don't know. He's not the type of guy I thought would do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not really sure. They say that Isaac Newton was one of the first people who actually started doing that. You know, shaving off, you know, coin clipping and stuff like that. But he did that at when he was the master of the Royal Mint. So he was doing it, you know, I guess for good reasons. Okay, but here, it explains here that if the coin was large, a hole could be punched out of the middle and the face of the coin hammered to close up the hole. The coin could then be sawn in half and a plug of metal extracted from the interior. And after you fill the hole with cheaper metal, the two halves will be welded back together. The idea of plugged quarters and plugged dimes eventually yielded the common phrase, not worth a plugged nickel, emphasizing the worthlessness of such a tampered coin. So I guess if he's saying to him, you know, watch out for, don't take any plugged nickels, meaning if you're going to get treasure, you should make sure that you get something that's worthwhile.
Real thing.
Could be. And then Tilly screams out, hey, George, your suitcase is leaking. Which, again, I don't really get the reference because it's, you know, maybe she's saying, you know, if you're out at sea already or something like that, because they are talking about, you know, Captain Cook and sea legs or something like that.
It's almost as if she heard the earlier conversation about having to use it as a raft.
Maybe. Don't know. And then George continues down the street after listening to the three of them. Did you see the pigeons on the corner of the frame there? Just sitting there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and, George then continues down the street. You know, he's holding up the suitcase, showing it to them. We see a store called Anderson's, which is right under the Bailey Building and Loan. And then we see two characters who are they're gonna pop up quite often throughout the rest of this movie. You have Ernie the taxi driver and Bert the cop.
Okay,
Bert
and Ernie.
Yes, right. Bert and Ernie, which apparently, you know, as I mentioned, you know, in the first week of this show, apparently there is no connection to the Bert and Ernie of the Muppets.
Sesame Street.
It was going to of the second of Sesame Street, right? Not the Muppets, sorry. And Ernie's, I never noticed this before. On Ernie's taxi, it says Ernie's Taxicab. You know, that's the name of his company. He's definitely got something. You know, he's keeping it unique. And Bert is sitting there looking at a newspaper. Now, did you see what's written on the newspaper?
Smith wins nomination.
Yes. Do you have any idea who they're talking about?
Could it be an in-joke to Mrs. Smith gets to Washington?
No.
Was that made afterwards? No.
No. It theoretically it could be, but I believe it's not. We can also see that it's called the Bedford Falls Sentinel. Mm. Now, that's the name of the newspaper here. Alfred Smith was the Democratic Party nominee in 1928. Okay, he ran against Herbert Hoover in 1928 and lost. And Al Smith was actually the 42nd governor of New York. And he also was the first Roman Catholic to be nominated for president of the U.S. From a major party. He lost. He did not win, but he was governor four times. He was governor in 1918, 1922, 24, and 26. He actually lost the governorship in 1920, but then was able to move back in 1922. And he eventually he seeked the Democratic nomination for president in 1924, but did not get it. And then he tried again in 1928, and he actually won it. So the date of him winning the nomination was on June 28th, 1928. So that is when this is taking place. We are now in 1928. So this is 9 years after the previous events. So if George was 12 when, you know, everything happened in the drugstore and all that stuff, so it means that George is now 21.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, first of all, I think it's really cool that we have this subtle reference as to what the date is. You know, they never tell us in the movie what year it is or anything like that.
Well, I guess, yeah, later on you do get the start of the Depression. That should have been a clue for me. I thought about that after I'd already said my my guess earlier. Yeah,
correct. But again, the idea that you know, we talked earlier in the week about the fact that Capra was a very visual director. So just to throw out something like that, I mean, most people won't get it, but it's very possible. Most people won't get it now, but it's very possible that back in 1946, when people were watching this movie, so, you know, those people all knew who Al Smith was.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very possible that's the connection to the whole thing. I mean, in the script, it says that it's 1928. You know, when he shows up in the luggage shop, it says luggage shop 1928. So it actually tells us the how much time has passed.
All right.
Again, in the copy of the script that I have, whether it's so we know that George was born in 1907. So if he was born in 1907, this is 1928. So it's he's approximately 21 at this point. You know, which makes sense. I mean, later in the week next week we'll talk more about after they finish graduation and things like that. So that also says something about the whole thing. So yes, it's 1928, and you know, we have Bert and Ernie start talking with George, showing how friendly they are. So George goes, "Hey Ernie," and then he goes, "Hi Ernie, hey Bert, hiya George. Hey, I'm a rich tourist today. How about driving me home in style? Hop in, Your Highness, hop in." "Yes, sir. And for the carriage trade, I put on my hat." And we see Ernie put on his hat as he says it. And he says, as he's doing that, we see a beautiful woman walking by. And she goes, "Good afternoon, Mr. Bailey." And he goes, "Hello, Violet. Hey, you look good. That's some dress you got on there." "This old thing? Well, I only wear it when I don't care how I look." And I mean, I think it's great that they already at this point are showing us the relationship between Violet and George. I mean, we saw it briefly when he was younger. Last week we talked about it, you know, where she talks about the fact that she, you know, what's wrong with loving all boys, which says something about her standing, even in that day and age, of what type of girl she was. But, you know, the idea that she's walking by and she like struts by, and as she's doing it, we see Ernie and Bert and George all basically staring at her for obvious reasons.
Staring the head over the taxi cabs. And
yes, they do that really well. You know, like they see her walk by, and then the crane shot moves up a little bit to show above the, you know, above the top of the car, and both Bert and George, their heads like pop up as they're continuing to watch her go by. She crosses the street, and as she's crossing the street, there's an elder, middle-aged man walking in the opposite direction that looks at her and just stops in the middle of the street and like stares at her. And then then we hear a horn honk, and he basically jumps up. And he's completely shocked, taken by surprise for having looked at, you know, this woman walking across the street.
Yeah, I love that little moment.
It's great because, again, it shows the idea that okay.
She's the town hottie sort of thing.
Exactly. She's a woman that everyone, you know, will stop and stare at. And apparently this is another man who will do that. You know, I was looking, but I couldn't find a reference to who, you know, if this is an actor or if it's you know, just one of the crew members or something like that. It's very hard to tell because a lot of the uncredited people here is just, you know, it just says a townsperson or something like that. We don't see something in IMDb that'll say, oh, this is the guy crossing the street, you know, getting interrupted or something like that. But, you know, throughout the course of the movie, we will talk about many of these uncredited people because a lot of them stand out and you can tell who they are. But this is unfortunately not one of them. And as he gets startled, the minute ends. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, it's just a fun, light kind of light moment. I guess it's more character building stuff, really, and it, again, showing that everyone loves him in town. He's got friends all over town. And he's goofing around. He's got his little. He does that little thing when he's chatting to the guys in the building alone. He kind of does that weird kind of squat or whatever with his legs as well. It was a bit of a very James Stewart like touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also love how you can like see names of all these different stores and places in the, you know, we see florists, but we don't see the name of the shop. But you have the Bijou Theater and Anderson and Mackenzie Music Store and things like that. Like they really took their time, and you can even see a sign for Ernie's Taxi Cab above Violet as she's walking away, as she's walking down the street. So it means that even Ernie has a he has a store, or you know, a storefront or something like that.
It's quite a well-stocked town for what is supposed to be quite small. There's all sorts in there.
Yeah, it's true. Every Thursday we have a segment called Jimmy Stewart Thursday, where my guests will give their top five Jimmy Stewart performances. What have you got for us, David?
Oh, well, this is tough. Jimmy Stewart's in so many good films. I can't even believe some of the films that I've missed out on my list that are brilliant. But
well, it's never too late.
No. Well, no. As I say, the ones I'm happy with, the ones in there, but I'm missing.
No, I'm saying it's never too late to add to the number of Jimmy Stewart movies you've seen. Not necessarily for this list, but in general, for your own personal.
Oh no. I've seen loads of Jimmy Stewart films, but although there's a few big names that I haven't seen actually. I was just talking about ones that I've missed from my list. I mean, from my five, there's ones that could easily make it, but. He's in so many good films. I had to whittle it down.
What have you missed? Which big ones do you think you've missed?
Oh well, I'll save it and I'll count down my list first, and then I might do honorable mentions because it'll give it away if I miss.
That's true.
But yeah, cool. Well, number five, I am going to go with Winchester 73.
I am such a fan of that movie.
Oh yes,
I love Port. What are they called? Portland 2?
Yeah, portmanteau. Yeah. It is that. It's slightly different. I guess it is a portmanteau film, but it kind of ties together quite nicely. It's not quite as the stories aren't quite as separated as some of the portmanteau films.
No, the portmanteau. But, the idea is that the main character is an object, and the fact that the object here is this gun is what always gets me with that one.
Okay, right, yeah. But no, I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm a big Western fan. And a big Jimmy Stewart fan, and it's just perfection. He did a lot of great westerns with that was one of Anthony Mann's ones, isn't it? Yeah, it is. I think so. But this is my favourite. I think it was the first of their kind of collaborations that I saw. It's not the first that they did, and it might be actually. I'm getting all my facts wrong, but it's really tight. As you say, the kind of concept. Fitting everything around this rifle is very cleverly done, and I think Jimmy Stewart's great in the film, as always. But he shows his darker side in the westerns that he did with Anthony Mann, and it certainly shows it here. And it's just brilliant. And then number four, I'm going to go with The Shop Around the Corner. This is one I only just saw recently in prep for the podcast. I just noticed it on my shelf, I hadn't seen it yet. I was like, all right, let's give it a shot. It's a film that later got remade as You Got Mail, but this is the better film. This is it's just pure perfection. It's Ernst Lubitsch. You can't go wrong with Ernst Lubitsch, and it's just a sheer delight. It's also got a darker edge than I expected. There's some quite with the guy who runs the shop tries to commit suicide at one point, and which kind of ties it in with It's Wonderful Life, I guess. But it really surprised me. I was expecting something light and fun, kind of something, a nice kind of old classic. But I adored it. I thought it was fantastic. And another one, number three, is another film that caught me by surprise, and that's Destry Rides Again. I don't think enough people talk about this film. I absolutely loved this. I saw it for the first time, I think, just like a year or two ago, and it was just so much fun, and it's so tightly done. It's so, I absolutely adored it. It's Marlon Dietrich and starring alongside Jimmy Stewart, and they're both brilliant. Yeah, I just had an absolutely fell in love with that when I saw it recently. Number two, It's a Wonderful Life. I've mentioned this already, and obviously this whole podcast is a series about this. So yeah, enough said.
Really? I'm not familiar with that. What happens in that movie?
But number one, for me, it has to be a Rear Window. I'm a big Hitchcock fan, and I know that the big one that's missing from my list is obviously Vertigo, and that's a lot of people's favorite Hitchcock film. It was recently voted, well, not in the recent poll, but the previous Sight and Sound poll, is the greatest film of all time, and I agree it is superb, but it doesn't grab me in the same way emotionally as the other films I've had on this list, and it doesn't grab me in the same way that Rear Window does. I love every second of Rear Window. It's a great simple concept executed to perfection, and Jimmy Stewart's incredible as always. So yeah, that had to be my number one. But yeah, as I say, Vertigo is the big one that's missing. What other ones? Anatomy of a Murder, that could have made the list. The Man Who Shot
Liberty Valance. Have you ever seen either of those?
Oh no, I have. These are just ones that are missing that could have easily made the list. And my top five was hard. I say no, I love them all. The Philadelphia Story, that's a great film. The Flight of the Phoenix, I love The Flight of the Phoenix. Bend of the River, that's really good. The Man from Laramie. He's been in so many great films. But as I say, Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington, I remember loving it, but it's been too long, so it kind of lost it from there. Mm-hmm. But he's just an absolute treasure, really. He's one of my favorite actors.
I'm glad you were able to join us to talk about it.
Yep.
I've actually never seen Dust Free Rides again, so probably by the time this is recorded, I will have released, I will have seen it. So.
It's hugely underrated. Well, I say, I don't know if it's necessarily underrated, like it's always well reviewed, but it's one that people don't seem to talk about when they talk about Jimmy Stewart and stuff. And it's I don't know, it seems to have gotten slightly forgotten, not completely. I mean, you can get it on Criterion and stuff like that, but I don't know, it's one you don't hear people talk about, but I think it's easily up there with Jimmy Stewart's best. I think it's a fantastic film. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I will go check that out. All right, so David, do you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, head over to blueprintreview.co.uk to see all my movie reviews, generally shiny disc reviews.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just a search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.